Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM in 2024. Happy New Year to you. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And here's where I interview authors about their latest novels. Today my guest is Maxim Jakubowski. And honestly, it's hard not to reach for superlatives when you describe the man because he's been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. I'll try not to embarrass him too much. But it's also a little bit personal for me because I've enjoyed his writing, the anthologies he's edited, the criticism he did for The Guardian, has done for Crime Time, and still does for Crime Time, actually, with the Tinamax column. And I bought books from his bookshop, and books that he published that introduced me to a whole world of noir. And I've come to know him a little bit, and he's certainly one of the people in publishing that I look up to. So, editor, writer, critic, publisher, bookseller, an all-round promoter of literature across various genres. Maxim Jakubowski's new novel, Just a Girl with a Gun, was published in November. As with all Maxim's writing, it defies easy classification, but it oozes noir sensibilities. And Maxim will tell us a lot more about that.
Well, hello and welcome back to Crime Time FM, Maxim.
Nice to be back.
Yeah, well, this time we're actually going to be talking about you and your books. That makes a change, doesn't it?
Well, maybe.
Okay, look, I want to start with something. I mean, we might as well just jump in. We're going to talk about Just a Girl with a Gun. We'll certainly get to that. But I would like to ask you about your writing in a more sort of general sense. People like to pigeonhole stuff. Your writing persistently resists any kind of pigeonholing, I think it's fair to say. So you started out writing sci-fi. You moved on to writing crime, which is sci-fi, supernatural, elements of erotica. It's all in there. The Louisiana Republic, for instance, is a perfect example of that. And I just think this splitting it into subgenres is perhaps an odd way to look at it. Perhaps the better way to look at it around is the sort of color and flavor in your books. And I'm going to suggest a sort of noir sensibility and a kind of worldview. I mean, how do you see it?
Well, basically, I used to work in publishing for many years. And of course, one of the... It's like Elmore Leonard's, was it 10 or 12 lessons in what not
right.
to write? And one of the 10 lessons in publishing, certainly of my generation, was never switch genres. And
yeah,
obviously,
right.
maybe there's a rebel inside me who goes up against this idea that you can't switch genres. But also, it's something I just enjoy doing. I don't feel... I want to restrict myself to a particular genre, and particularly when I have written crime, it has certainly never dawned on me that I should even write a series. I mean, some people have joked that it would be impossible for me to write a series because so many of my main protagonists are killed off by the end of every book, which precludes...
It's a point.
Possibility. It does make me obviously uncommercial, niche, cult, but I think the one thing in common with my writing in all genres, whether it's science fiction and fantasy, erotica or crime, is that basically, I mean, as you said, there is a noir sensibility. I mean, it's the way I see the world.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about. As I said, I think it's more about the unifying kind of thing rather than people breaking it down. It's just sometimes these barriers. I suppose what I'm trying to get at is in life, there aren't those barriers. We're happy and we're sad at the same time. We're suffering from grief and we're falling in love at the same time. And in a sense, representing that in fiction, then why would you say, well, okay, a book's got to be one specific thing rather than something else?
No, I'm very much so. I'm rather fortunate insofar as for 2/3 of my writing career, I had obviously full-time jobs and in many cases very well paid jobs. So maybe it helped my self-indulgence, because I knew that it didn't matter whether I got a two-figure advance, a three-figure advance or a four-figure advance.
Right.
I was quite happy as long as I wrote the book that I wanted to write, that it sold and hopefully would find its own public. And if a book if I only earned a few thousand pounds a year from my writing, then it didn't matter because I was earning obviously enough to support my family and myself during those years. As obviously I worked briefly in the food industry. Well, I worked in publishing in France, then came back to the UK and worked in the food industry as I couldn't migrate into British English language publishing, as I was seen as an outsider, and these were very
established. Yeah, of course, it would have been very strict times, wouldn't it?
Publishing. So because I spoke various languages, I had to find a job, and obviously languages, export. So I became export director of a food company, and I had a 9-year career in the food industry, ending up as a vice president of one of the biggest American food conglomerates, running the London and European office, but actually based in Panama. My money was being paid in, my salary was being paid in Panama, which was quite convenient. all the time I was just writing on the side. So I was somewhat privileged in that respect, insofar as I've never had to write for the money. And when I eventually left publishing, I thought I'd just move to writing full time. Then I got somewhat bored. I can only write 3 or 4 hours a day. It does take a lot out of me, because I do take it very seriously, even if I jest about it. Then I thought, well, I've got to do something with my days, not just taking the kids to school, picking them up from school, as they were still of a school age at the time. I'd been a client at Forbidden Planet, as I'm a great science fiction and fantasy reader. I'd noticed, of course, during the course of all my travels in America, that there were at the times probably 10 to 15 crime and mystery bookshops in North America. And I thought, well, nobody's tried it here. And I mentioned it to a few people who said, no, it'll never work, which, of course, was an incentive to invest some of my savings. And I opened Murder One, and that lasted 21 years. And Murder One was, for many years, very profitable.
I'm certainly one of the places to go. I mean, if you're in London, I visit London. And, of course, Murder One was a place to go. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the wonderful thing about it is, obviously, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but there is now what I would term a sort of Murder One generation amongst British writers and publishers. When we had the launch of Hannibal, we did opening, who was number two in the queue there, a gentleman called Mark Billingham, who hadn't written a word.
all know where that went.
I was speaking just 2 days ago with my CWA hat on, with the editorial director of Orion, and he said, oh, I was one of your customers at Murder One. And so many people have now come up, writers, editors, and saying, oh, no, I mean, our love of crime, or in some cases our careers, to Murder One, which obviously is quite humbling and very satisfying also. Obviously, at the time, some of them were just rather annoying customers who came in with too many questions when I was trying to do a bit of writing.
Well, I won't bore you with my own story in that sense, though. So is it kind of serendipity more than planning? You see, it looks like a pattern now when you look back on it. You're a publisher, an editor, a writer, obviously, and involved in so many things within the writing industry. But I don't suppose you left school thinking about that. But is it sort of more serendipity than planning?
No. I wouldn't say planning, but basically I was bitten by the bug at a very young age. I was living in Paris. My father was a businessman who had one book in his whole life. My mother was obviously much more intellectual, but she died when I was quite young. But I loved reading from an early age, and we lived in the 20th arrondissement in Paris, I quickly exhausted the books in the junior section of the library, and my mother gave me her library card, so I was allowed, with no censorship or oversight involved, in just picking and reading any book I wanted. And I basically became a mad reader. I mean, I was reading 5 or 6 books a week at the time. At the age of 13, one of my teachers in Paris, his name was Monsieur Laurent. I think every fortnight we had to do an essay in French. And, usually sort of boring, what is your favorite food? One day he advised the class, you're all being a bit predictable. Use your imagination. You don't have to say exactly what you did on your holiday. And in fact, that right. was the thing for that particular fortnight's essay. I mean, we're talking about 200 or 300 handwritten pages in children's
500 words thing.
Yeah. And somehow it struck me, use your imagination. I'd spend my holidays in the Alps on a bicycle, just riding along. So I invented this story where basically I was on my bicycle. I mean, my only ambition was not to be a writer. I wanted to be a cyclist in the Tour de France.
Right.
I was basically daydreaming. My whole holiday was cycling all around and daydreaming. I was actually in the Tour de France. And so I wrote this essay. He said, use your imagination. Suddenly, an eagle swoops down from the mountain, picks me up from my bike, takes me to a nest at the top of the mountain. Now, God knows what happened afterwards. And it was totally imaginary.
And I'm sure absolutely different to every other essay that was handed in that week.
The following week, basically, the best essay was always read out to the class. My essay was read out. It was put on the wall of the class as a best essay of the fortnight or month. And then, I thought, I can do this. For the next 4 or 5 months, I was always the best essay. I was always on the wall until towards the end, Monsieur Laurent came to me and said, you are the best writer in the class, but for the next few weeks, we'll choose something else. It doesn't mean that what you've done isn't good. But I basically, from that moment onwards, I just wanted to be a writer. And I started writing for French science fiction magazines.
Obviously, yes, right.
I had this great advantage, having been brought up in France from the age of 3. I was bilingual and I was reading science fiction. So my first publication was, in fact, 5 lines in the reader's column of a French science fiction magazine saying, your issue was very good, but I liked this story and I didn't like that story or something. And then I started on my day off from school, because it was Thursday at the time in France, I went to the magazine and sort of hung around in reception and started meeting some other fans and some of the writers. Then they realized that obviously I was bilingual and they said, oh, I mean, I was only 15 at the time.
Right, yes.
And they said, oh, and you read science fiction in English? And they said, we've got a whole pile of magazines here. We've acquired rights to translate some stories. Would you like to translate some of them? I began translating some stories for them.
I see.
And then one day I started talking with French science fiction writers who were coming in. And I asked them, oh, how much are you paid per page? And they said, oh, we're being paid so many francs. And I realized that they were being paid 2 or 3 times as more than I was before my translation. I thought, well, I'll start writing. So I started writing. I didn't sell to them, to that particular magazine. I sold 1 year later to another magazine. And basically, you couldn't stop me from there onwards. My first book was published when I was 18 by the largest
book
in France, who hadn't a clue, of course, how young I was. Because it was all done through the post. I sent a proposal and they said, yeah, gave me a contract. And of course, I didn't have a bank account, so I couldn't cash the advance check. So I said, can you make it out to M. Jakubowski, as my father had the same initials? But they never knew who it was. And then, of course, spent the next 11 years writing basically my contribution to world literature. And of course, didn't publish a word for another 11 years.
It sometimes happens, yes. When it comes to the writing now, though, I mean, that was specifically science fiction. When it comes to the writing now, though, what sets the tones and that in the novel? And when you talk about the cross-genre type of thing, is it that the story, once you've got this idea, it goes where it goes? Is it that simple?
I think I'm not really an ideas person, which is why, in fact, I've slowly moved away from science fiction.
Right.
I'm a people person. I want to basically get under the skin of my characters, and the characters then dictate the story. Yes, there will be. Obviously, I will have an idea of the theme and more or less a direction of where the story is going. But most important are the characters. And and I make no secret that not so much when I was younger, but now, in fact, more and more of the characters are just facets of myself, whether they be male or female. Obviously, as is well known, I wrote a rather notorious erotica series, right, in opposition to 50 Shades, which sold millions of copies and was written.
This is where you dropped a bit about, we're not going to tell people the name of the character because you're copyrighted on that, aren't you? Or you're prohibited, is that?
Oh, the name
of the author and the series.
Well, I mean, everybody knows who it was.
Yes.
When you just look at the Sunday Times bestseller list, you can see 50 Shades there and mine are number 5 or 6 for weeks on end. Oddly enough, it wasn't me who decided that it would have a female pen name. It was basically the supermarkets, because obviously,
right,
they saw it as Mummy Paul or whatever it was called at the time, and it was the supermarkets who insisted on having a female pen name.
Right.
But as I said, for me, it's the characters, and I mean, more and more, and it's quite odd because in a way, it's probably the reverse of other people's careers when they start with more autobiographical things, and I'm in fact veering to that towards the end of my career, becoming
right.
more.
Do you find writers are sort of more reluctant to honestly admit that? But of course, the truth is, a character has to come from inside anyway, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I still create obviously a lot of characters out of basically sand, dust, and air, but. I mean, I do reread what I've written, and I, even though lots of people like them, I still find sometimes, oh, that's a character in which I haven't really put anything of myself, so it right. doesn't feel enough to me.
Doesn't come alive for you in the same way.
Like, I mean, it's like Cornelia, who's one of the main characters of Just a Girl with a Gun. I mean, Cornelia came to me nearly 35 years ago.
All right.
Write a story in a collection for Serpent's Tale, which I edited, called London Noir, and I came up with this story about this American female hit woman who comes to Paris to kill.
I've forgotten all about that, you know. Yes, right, of course. London Noir sitting upstairs with an awful lot of your collections, I have to admit.
And that's where, I mean, I came up with Cornelia, obviously, who was named after Cornell Woolrich. Then over the years, she's kept on coming back. I mean, I don't do series, but some of the minor characters occasionally move from book to book, and Cornelia has appeared as a minor character in, I think, in 3 novels and probably about 6 or 7 short stories. And then I decided that I thought that Just a Girl with a Gun might be my final novel. So I thought she deserves her own novel. I mean, I love Cornelia. Lots of readers have commented how much they liked her. So I thought I'd bring her back. I did cannibalize 1 or 2 short stories, and making changes, so that the chronology worked. And obviously she became one of the 2 main characters, if not the main character, of Just a Girl with a Gun. And Cornelia, there again, I mean, when I write about Cornelia, it's not in the first person, but I mean, it's the old French Flaubert and Madame Bovary.
Okay.
Madame Bovary, c'est moi. Well, Cornelia, c'est moi. Even though she's female, which I'm not, she's a stripper, which I'm not. Basically,
and a killer, which hopefully you're not.
No comment. And basically, I mean, I know her so well. I mean, I'm inside her head by now, which is why I wanted to give her a final hurrah with just a girl.
So let's look at that then, because you like to have an initial, you like to have an opening, don't you? And you like to have an ending. So is it sort of Cornelia then that decides how the rest of the novel goes, or how, you know, this idea that you have of her, is that what it is? It's you following Cornelia's journey then?
Well, when it comes to Just a Girl with a Gun, which I said is the first and last Cornelia novel, and incorporates some of the short stories in which she'd appeared. Basically, I knew I wanted to give her her own novel. And so I knew the opening, I knew the ending, because obviously both of them were two short stories, a story in Paris Noir. No, no, sorry, it wasn't London Noir, it was Paris Noir.
Right.
I did, which was another one I did for Serpent's Tale. Yeah, London Noir was another story altogether, which had, in which Cornelia doesn't appear, but the owner of a bookshop on Charing Cross Road did. And which, I mean, as in a party, when the audiobook came out, I listened to the audio recording of a story about the owner of a bookshop on Charing Cross within that particular anthology. And the narrator had an American accent. I've never listened to an audio of any of my books since.
And then
anyway, with Just a Girl of a Gun, I knew the beginning, I knew the ending, but I had no clue what I was going to put in between. It was like the desert. After I'd done the first three chapters, which were partly reusing some older material, I really was facing a total desert. I really didn't know what was going to come.
Right.
And I thought that I'd done another story about, in a tiny a charity anthology, I think in Scotland some years, for a Scottish publisher or editor some years back. And it took me weeks to find it in my old laptops.
Because right.
It wasn't one of my better stories, but it had basically, it had been inspired by an Edward Hopper painting, in fact, Laundromat. And it was about a man outside looking at the characters in the bar.
In the bar, yeah.
Mm. Was it
cafe goodnight? Type?
Phillies, I think. I come in, not Laundromat. And I thought, maybe if I bring him in, and then maybe, because he was a character who interested me, but I didn't really know what to do with him after the short story.
And this is Hopley.
Him, he killed, he went. And of course, that's a character called Hopper. And I thought, I want to know more about this character. So, I mean, in a way, he's the other side of the coin. He has similarities with Cornelia because, of course, we are both killers. They both actually unknowingly work for the same organization when they do work, although they are quite separate and they're quite cold-hearted. And I want to see what would happen when they met. And then they meet, so that meant I needed a backstory about the organization. I had to bring in some of the characters because obviously what happens, and not a major spoiler, is that somebody who was friendly with one of the victims of one of Cornelia's hits, or was it? I can't remember. It might have been one of Hopper's hits.
It was his hit.
It was one of his hits. Had collateral damage. He was obliged to kill an innocent witness, and a friend of the witness then gets on the trail and by mistake blames Cornelia. And this is, by then, Cornelia and Hopper have fallen in love. If you can call it a love affair, it's a rather perverse love affair. And that gave me basically the fictional spring to take the book ahead. I had the backstory, I had the organization, I had the characters, and then it was just a question of filling that bridge between the beginning of the ending of the book. And then in the rewrites, obviously, of making the concordance work.
It's fascinating. I want to pick up on that. Just one thing, though. You called him Hopley in the book.
Oh, yes, Hopley, sorry.
Right. It's fine, but, you know, just...
Well, obviously, we were talking about Edward Hopper, but, of course...
Yes, Cornell the influence.
His real name was Cornell Hopley Woolwich.
Right.
And he also wrote one novel as George Hopley.
There is an interesting point. Now you mention that. I can see now. I was looking at the cover of the book, and I thought it's Hopper-esque. With the name Hopley, so...
When the publisher said, the publisher came up with an image, which I thought I hated, because I'd seen it so often before my other books. A nude female limb, a gun, or a high heel.
All right.
I said, I want something different. He said, well, what would you like? And I said, well, the book is very much Woolwich and Edward Hopper influenced. He said, well, we'll look at Edward Hopper, and they went through the Edward Hopper sort of a archive, so to speak. And it found out that obviously the first third of his life, the images are now in the public domain. However,
right,
the images weren't noir enough. So we had to take a later one, which was copyrighted. And then the publisher found an illustrator who basically took those elements and did a new image, which was obviously totally Hopper inspired. Because obviously, we're not cheating. And
has the books in the background to stay on theme too.
A character from the Phillies bar, taken out of context, put into a library with a gun on the table. And he's done it very cleverly. It really does look like an Edward Hopper.
It does. No, absolutely. It really does. I want to draw something else in here at this point, and it's really around that thing of noir. Because for you, it was important. I mean, the French, I suppose, in a way, kept the flame alight when it sort of died off a bit in Britain and America, and you were aware of that. And of course, later came on to publish works by Burnett and McCoy and, you know, some of the classics. And again, to be fair, Black Box, that's where I got my introduction. You know, I knew Hammett. Of course, I knew Chandler. But this was an introduction to sometimes very much darker writers. But that's really important to you in the context of your crime writing, isn't it?
It is. Basically, I mean, that's where my tastes as a reader and a reviewer are. I mean, I'm much with a noir, although I have one soft spot in Golden Age crime for locked room mysteries.
I love locked room mysteries.
But obviously, like any crime reader and writer, I was brought up on Agatha Christie. I wasn't brought up on Enid Blyton because, obviously, being brought up in France, I really started with Jules Verne.
Right.
Hence my moving initially into science fiction. But obviously, I read, obviously, Agatha Christie. But then after Agatha Christie, I was reading a lot of, I won't say noir, but certainly would-be hard-boiled crime and mystery books, which were translated into French by people like Peter Shaney, James Hattie, etc., and then on to a number of French writers in the genre. So I was always attracted, although, to be utterly honest, I think what attracted me, because obviously I read basically Chase, Shaney and others, Brett Halliday, Dakin. I mean, I was 15, 16, and one of the main attractions was not that they were very readable books and very compelling, is that there was always that hint of sex in them. And which obviously in science fiction at the time, this was years before science fiction sexed up to a minor extent,
right,
like Philip Roze Farmer, etc. So my initial introduction was because obviously they were real people. People were having sex, even though obviously in many cases it was just suggested. End of chapter, the light dims or the door closes.
Sure. And you know what's happening, but it's in your head.
That for me was very exciting because, of course, there was never any sex in Agatha Christie or Jules Verne. And I said, I mean, I was always interested by the what I would term the mechanics between men and women from an early age. Maybe it has skewed my perception of it throughout my life. But it's basically something I keep on writing about. As I said initially, for me, it's not so much the story, it's the characters. And basically, if you have characters of flesh and blood, basically you have flesh, you have blood, you have sex. And yeah,
absolutely.
I have actually adding sexual elements, which I hope are not seen as gratuitous in my books, because obviously for me they are part and parcel of relationships with older relationships or more modern relationships.
I agree with you.
When I was writing science fiction and fantasy, my editors said, oh, less sex, please, Jakubowski. Then I started writing crime and I was told less sex. Or they wouldn't tell me. They would tell my agent, who'd then convey it to me, and I'd say...
And you'd say, get lost.
I'm not budging. if you don't want the books, I'll publish them elsewhere.
No, I think this, again, it goes back to that thing I said about a kind of false distinction, because it's daft. I mean, I understand why, for instance, if you have a horror film, you might not want sex in it because they're worried about crossing boundaries. And you know, and I want to talk about that in a little bit in the context of your book in terms of boundaries. But sorry, let me make this a bit more clear. This kind of insistence on splitting off erotica and making it something, you know, you add it into the book, you take it out of the book. I think the reality is that perhaps when you're talking about character, and that's what we've agreed is the essential in your novels, it's about what motivates character. And perhaps the purest of all motives in terms of human behavior is love and lust and the other things that we have between each other. Money can still be driven by lust and love. So can any other motive that you look for why a crime might be committed. So in essence, what you're doing is you're dealing with the essence of people when you write about a book. And if it has erotica in it, it's because that's the essence of people. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you couldn't have sort of put it any better. I mean,
that's great. I've answered my own question and ruined it.
at the root of everything I try and do, really. I mean, some people find it a bit extreme at times, but I'm not there to self-censor.
Mm. No, you have to tell the story the way you want to tell the story. I think also, I mean, for me, I think, for instance, if we take just The Girl with the Gun, the story starts more as an erotic story in the sense that you set up the two characters. And I think we really have to understand them. And I don't want to explain too much to people about where that goes. But we absolutely have to understand the characters before I think the noir element of the story comes in, if you like. And the story starts to take off as a plot, in a sense. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, the plot followed the characters. The characters came first, then the plot came. But then it becomes like a hall of mirrors. That was the whole idea. And there are so many, like, I wouldn't say in-jokes, but there are so many little references, which something will be mentioned in an early chapter, which I wouldn't say it doesn't make sense, but it just happens to be there. And then it's only 100 pages later that that particular strand comes into the open. There are lots of different strands throughout, and hopefully I've managed to pull them all together by the ending, including, spoiler alert, a slight supernatural angle, right, which, in fact, I can neither confirm or deny.
Yes. Okay. I think best to leave it there, perhaps. If we look at Cornelia then, as a character, she's a killer and an erotic dancer, as you pointed out. How would you describe her at the moment we open the novel? You know, this character you are setting up for us before you set up Hopley.
Well, we open the novel with Cornelia, all has already been active as a hit woman for years. So the later flashbacks to the beginning of her career show that she's actually obviously very, very cold-hearted and very logical. I mean, she is missing something.
Yes, could we say empty, in a sense?
Absolutely, absolutely, which is why when she falls for Hopley, obviously right, things start to go wrong, as they would do. But Cornelia, like me, is a book collector. So obviously I use a lot of book collecting lore and some of my own collection in the book. So that helped me basically to not only the Cornelia c'est moi aspect, but also in, I think, in giving it giving body to.
Yeah, I think I would say that it becomes more than that in the book, in that there is a direct reason for it that later appears in the story. So you set something up and it comes back. So it does have that specific role in the story. But yeah, I see. So you're saying in a way that it grounds the character for you in your own experience, in a sense, because you share this love.
It makes Cornelia so much more real to me. I mean, there are two types of lust. Obviously, you have sexual lust, which obviously occurs throughout all my books, but also in Cornelia and my case, there is a lust for rare books.
Yes, right.
So it's another way in which I identify it with the wonderful Cornelia. But yeah. I mean, I can see her in my mind. I mean, it's like a movie. I mean, I'm a great movie fan, and
is that generally the way? Are you a visual sort of author anyway? You see scenes and
yeah. Mm. I mean, I'm a great movie fan, and basically, a lot of what I write, basically, I virtually see it, and I'm just basically describing it as I write. It's rare that I don't see the story like a movie in front of my eyes as I'm typing away, which in fact is the way I know that something is really working, that I'm faithful to my own writing, fictional writing principles. I'm just hopefully about to start my next novel. I thought of the one with Cornelia would be the last, but then I thought, there is still one more I want to write. And
it's funny because I thought you'd almost said, you know, well, that's it now, packing up. And then you came back and said, well, I don't know. I have this idea based on it. Was it the Boris V and it's Autumn in Peking?
Yes, it is. Basically, what happened is that back in June or July, a Brazilian letterpress publisher of very rare, beautiful, rare books.
Right.
Got in touch. My name was mentioned to him by another writer who knew that Boris Vian, the French writer, is one of my top 10 authors, and said, we're going to publish a small anthology of stories inspired by Boris Vian. I said, oh, yeah, I'm in.
Right.
I wrote the story, which is called Springtime in New Orleans, which doesn't take place in springtime and doesn't take place in New Orleans, of course.
That's my nod. Well, naturally.
That's my nod to Autumn in Peking, which
right.
is neither in autumn nor in Peking, but which is nonetheless a wonderful book, wonderfully romantic book. And also, that's the other thing which I like, obviously, both in Woolwich and in Vian, and which I hope is apparent in my books. They are rather romantic, in fact. One of my erotic books many years ago, in which Cornelia appears as a very minor character, was called Confessions of a Romantic Pornographer, which I think I'd be happy to see on my tombstone. This Brazilian publisher got in touch, and obviously they weren't offering money, they were just offering a copy of the book. They're only publishing 65 copies, each numbered and signed, each hand-printed on special vellum size. And I've checked books by this publisher. Within a few months, books are worth about £2,000 or £3,000. So I did this story, which is quite a long story. It's about nearly 8,000 words, called Springtime in New Orleans. And I think it's coming out any day now in Brazil. I won't see copies until the new year. Mm-hmm. Or a copy.
Yeah, a copy. Mm.
The story's been nagging at me ever since. I mean, 8,000 words for me is a long short story. Most of my short stories are between 4,000 maximum 6,000, more likely,
right?
3,000 to 5,000 words. And I thought I wouldn't write another novel because I find novels very difficult to write, increasingly difficult to write. I much prefer writing short stories. And in fact, since Girl with a Gun.
Why did you say that then? Because, I mean, you went away on a cruise and wrote and gave us an update along the way, actually, which was interesting, with Just a Girl with a Gun.
Yeah.
And I got it done in, what, 6 weeks, something like that?
Well, I spend most of my life as an editor, so I do very little. I edit as I go along.
So you just stick with the first draft?
And all my publishers, when they come back, I never have more than about 10 or 12 little notes. Can you change?
Right.
And usually it's more a typing mistake or repetition of a word somewhere or something like that. So I do. And I force myself to write fast because I said I when I'm writing a novel, basically, it occupies, even though I'm only working 4 hours a day on it, I'm doing my 2,000 words a day. I can't, the novel is in my head all the time. It's when I'm sleeping, I can't. I suffer from insomnia. It's just almost like an illness. I really feel the tension. I've now written 21. I mean, with Just a Girl with a Gun, including obviously the pseudonymous books, was my 21st novel when I thought enough is enough. But and I love writing short stories. I mean, the first thing I did after Just a Girl with a Gun was to write half a dozen short stories in 3 months, which have all appeared or are about to appear in various
collections. Yes, yeah.
Springtime in New Orleans, the Vian story, I felt there's some lots of new characters. They're all new characters for me, apart from this wandering author who comes in and out of a story.
Right.
I often do recently. I thought there's the Butterfly Kid, there's Lily, the waitress from Nova Scotia. There's lots of characters. And I feel I want to go back to those characters. And right. I will expand the story and obviously bring in obviously a lot of new subplots. It's not a heavily plotted, it's more a story about odd people in an odd place. The story will be situated on an island in the middle of a sea of Exopotamia, which right. of course is of your reference from Autumn in Peking, which takes place in the desert.
Yeah.
Exopotamia, and the working title is Exopotamia. And as yet again, the main way for me now to write them these days, to write a novel these days, is actually to go on a long cruise where I have no interruptions.
I can imagine it's bliss as a writer if you can get that time. Yeah.
Oddly enough, it was Larry Block, Lawrence Block. Many years ago, we were talking about writing because at the time Larry was still writing a book a year, and he would always write them when he was traveling or in writer's colony. And he said, "Oh, you should try going on a cruise." He said, "It's like being in a writer's colony, so you can just concentrate on things. Food is being served; you don't have to do anything."
Yes, I suppose.
But he said, "But it's being like in a writer's colony without the writers." Bitching about about other authors, their publishers or agents. And I found out, Larry, actually, I don't know which ones, wrote several books on cruises.
Right.
And I've since found out that it's hearsay, because I haven't checked with him. I heard a couple of weeks ago that Felix Francis might actually have written one or two of his more recent books on cruise. So it's a formula, but
it's a trend.
It's a work. It's worked twice for me, so I'm going to have one more go.
Pick up on a couple of things you said there, actually. The first one is, it's about that idea of writing a first draft, editing it as you go along. I understand where all the experience comes in. But one of the things about a noir, and a thing about this book, is the way that all the little things you leave at the start of the novel that are indicators of something coming back later on in the novel. And that's a fairly complex structure. And it has to work very well in a noir, you know, to make it work. So you manage that all in your head as you go along. You kind of know where it's all going?
There was just one page of notes. When I started, I divided the book into its number of chapters and wrote two lines what the chapter was basically about. Two-thirds of the way through the book, I had to move some of the chapters.
Right.
Around, but that's the only structural editing I had to do.
No, I do honestly think that's incredible. I mean, the number of authors who wind up reverse engineering tons of stuff, you know, but it's just, as I said, it's the thing about the noir and how all these little points have to come together. One of the things about that is the other stories, of course, it's not just about Cornelia and it's not just about Hopley, but the other characters, Maxwell, as you pointed out, and others who come into the story and then have their own role at some point along the way. You do create very rounded characters because they have real stories that bring a lot of added elements to the novel. I'm trying not to say too much about what happens, but there are a few shocks in the way the novel goes at times. You know, you manage to put that punch in the gut in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that does come from some very rounded minor characters, if you like.
Well, I love all my characters.
Right.
And I said, even though I identify most strongly with the wonderful Cornelia, I'm as much Hopley maybe less so Maxwell. Basically, I basically try and, when I'm writing, I really do try and put myself, and this is why I find writing novels, because in a short story, you're only with a character for a week or so, time, which is what it usually takes me to write a short story, is a week. But when you're writing a novel, those characters are, they just won't let, they won't let go. I'm not saying what a lot of other writers say in interviews, that the characters dictate what is going on. I can feel them in my head, and that's why I hope I have given them strong backstories and that they're not cardboard characters. I mean, with my reviewing hat on, I read so many books which are wonderfully done, wonderfully structured, but we're basically, apart from the main character, and even then the main character has probably so many boxes which are ticked.
Right, yes, I see what you mean.
There's lover, widower, unfaithful husband, whatever, or woman with a past. I mean, I really want my characters and the characters I read about in other people's books, I want them basically to come alive. And I mean, the difficult thing about it is that obviously my books are not traditional, therefore there is an element of the absurd, of the Baroque sometimes,
yes,
of the romantic, of the ultra noir, of the obscene. So basically, I mean, for me, that's all part of the fabric
of life anyway,
of creating characters,
right.
Which is why I wouldn't be able to write a book.
One of the things that stands out in terms of the characters is the way that it's the randomness, really, isn't it? It's the fact that life occurs the way it occurs. You can set out to do all the good you want in the world, or you could set out to do all the bad, but something happens along the way. And that's so apparent in the story. And I suppose in a way, maybe that's very difficult to create, the idea of randomness when you actually are structuring something, but it comes across brilliantly.
I mean, for me, it comes naturally. On the other hand, what other people do incredibly well and naturally, I can't do.
Right.
I can't write a whodunit. I would get bored with it. I mean, it doesn't help in terms of sales, unless you click at a certain moment, which I did with my erotic books.
Yes.
My erotic books, obviously, I mean, when you read them, I'm sure that anybody who's read my crime or my fantasy books would know immediately that they're written by me, because my style and my storytelling is actually quite cliche. Well, yeah, and is quite recognizable.
And you wrote those with the same energy and drive towards character, of course, yes?
Well, I mean, my favorite one amongst the erotic books was actually the final book in the series, which after the first few books were selling over a million copies, that one only sold 85,000 copies because obviously the trend was coming to an end.
Right.
So the publishers dropped me. Now, I'd be very happy to sell 85,000 copies. And was a book called Mistress of Night and Dawn. By then, the series had done so well that I was given complete carte blanche. And it is, I mean, it is a complete fantasy. It's a story about a ball, a masked ball, which occurs every 10 years and has been getting into the Middle Ages. And it's a story about an orphan who's been brought up in ignorance of her status to become the next queen of the ball, and the book is called Mistress of Night and Dawn. And there again, I stole one of the main arguments from science fiction, in fact, from Ray Bradbury's The Illustrated Man, although with a twist, whereby when the character in Mistress of Night and Dawn becomes a woman, basically, every time she's made love to, and every time she orgasms, basically a small tattoo appears somewhere on her body.
Right.
And on the final day of the ball, when she is crowned queen of the ball, basically, she is made love to by a succession of men until her whole body is covered
covered in tattoo.
With the exception of her face. And that's basically the climax, in between inverted commas, of the book. And it's still one of my favorite books.
but didn't sell as well as the rest of the series. Or as you said, the era was coming to an end anyway.
The tsunami of mummy porn had come to an end because obviously publishers, and having been one for many years, like lemmings, if something works.
Yeah, they jump on trends.
Just do more and more. I mean, which is right now. I mean, right now we're... I think we're beginning to coming to the end of the domestic thriller genre, which started wonderfully with Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, but now has deteriorated. And obviously, I mean, like you, I get books in the post. You'll get two or three every week.
Yeah, you get these unique books that come in at two and three. Yes.
And then now if a new thing is romantasy or dark academia. And I mean, obviously, St. Dawn was a sort of dark academia book, but obviously with sex.
I've never been a big fan, though, of the idea of just the detective novel where, you know, somebody commits a murder, somebody solves a crime, and everybody goes home happy ever after. And one thing's for sure, there's certainly no resolution like that in your novels. In fact, there's an incredible resolution, and again, I won't say anything much about it, but let me put it in a certain way. A policeman who might, I don't know, take bribes, let's say, for instance, from a crime gang, might also catch a rapist and somehow feels he's balanced the karma in the world, if you like. So he's given himself a justification. And I would say that this book ends with an unusual, certainly a far more intriguing and interesting resolution, let's say. Would that be fair?
I would agree, yeah.
I suppose I took us down a path we can't really go there, I'm afraid. Just one other little point on Cornelia then, because you in the book she has a joke about Villanelle and how Jodie Comer plays the part. And obviously she predates Villanelle by some time, but was it a sort of a reaction to the fun but absolutely mindless sort of entertainment that is in a way, that kind of television program, if you like?
Well, obviously, I created Cornelia, as I mentioned, in the 1980s, obviously long before Villanelle. So that was my own private joke in the book. Although, obviously, I enjoyed certainly second series. And
when the writing was sparking.
When Phoebe Waller-Bridge was doing the writing. Mm. Because I think the books are pretty awful, oddly enough. No, that was just a private joke. But I mean, it's ironic that all these years later, obviously, there's been, and I'm sure there have been some more hit women around. But
yes, there's a few about.
My hit woman was one of the first, although not the first, because obviously there are hit women, or to a certain extent, femme fatale who kill in so many of, obviously, classical noir.
Yeah, I think the difference, I mean, there is a lot of stuff around, but it's emotionless in a sense. There's no depth to the characters involved in an awful lot of that writing. Let's talk about something else that is character, I think, in a way, and is important to you, and that's place. And, I mean, you don't write about London very often, certainly. But you do write about New Orleans and you write about New York, and that's relevant in this book. And for me, one of the books that it was most relevant was Death Has a Thousand Faces, which I thought was also a tender portrait, although they're dark stories, erotic stories, a few crime stories, but a very tender portrait of places that you love personally. So I suppose for you, they are characters.
I love writing about places, and as you said, I've virtually never written about London or the UK. Yeah. I love New Orleans. I've set three novels there and many short stories. I love New York. I don't like LA, and I've therefore not written many stories set in LA. But no, I do tend to write stories set in other places, but they are places I know. I would never write about a place that I hadn't visited or knew well. With regards to New Orleans, which is, as I said, probably my favorite place in the world. Despite the fact that I don't drink, and I'm not even a jazz fan. I'm more of a rock and roll or country person when it comes to musical tastes. But there's something about New Orleans that just caught my imagination. Mm. The moment I went there, and there was a time when I was there two or three times a year, and I think for 11 years in a row, spent New Year's Eve week in New Orleans. So, and I've made friends there, and it was quite amusing. Many years ago, my wife and I were having dinner with a local writer called O'Neill Deneau, who's appeared in some of my anthologies, who's an American Cajun, born New Orleans, born and bred crime author, who used to be a lieutenant in the New Orleans Police Department.
Right.
And we were at dinner one evening, and the ladies had gone to the powder room. We were just finishing off. And he leaned over to me and said, "Maxim, you know that story of yours? I'll come have a title now. It appeared in an anthology somewhere." He said, "You know that club you referred to in that area of the French Quarter? When I was in the police force, we always knew of its existence, but we could never find it." And I said, I only invented the place. And I was very, very proud of it. And in fact, later, his wife, obviously, who was an editor, edited an anthology of short stories called Erotic New Orleans. And I'm very proud that I'm the only non-New Orleans-born writer. I love writing about places, evoking places. For me, there's nothing romantic about the UK. I mean, who's going to write about driving up the M1?
We certainly don't have that feel of New Orleans. I agree with you about that. I was thinking that you also get that character, for instance, France, in this novel. And I don't know if you remember that memoir Catherine Millet wrote a few years ago. So it was about that subculture of French clubs. And it's almost like you've got that in the novel, and it spans the novel. At the same time, you've got the assassins. So it's sort of an underworld on top of an underworld in a city. And I thought that was beautifully structured. I do want to raise one other thing, because you do write, your output is phenomenal, I think, to be fair. And recently, of course, we've had The Death of Has a Thousand Faces. That was in 22. You've been involved in a lot of anthologies, Perfect Crime, for instance, and the Cornell Wooldridge one. But also very recently, it came out just before the Just a Girl with a Gun. And that was the J.G. Ballard anthology, which you put together.
From a Deep End, yeah.
Yeah, so an appropriate title as well. But, this must take up a lot of your time.
It doesn't.
Really?
I feel I'm twiddling my thumbs two-thirds of a day.
Right.
I feel I'm totally unproductive, actually, although when you look back at it, obviously. No, I mean, anthologies are a different kettle of fish. Basically, the great joy in doing anthologies is basically keeping my hand in at editing, because obviously I
did working with great writers, yeah.
As a commissioning editor. I've done so many, I wouldn't say that I can do them in my sleep, but I know how to put together an anthology. And it's also, I love, obviously, revealing new authors, bringing new faces, finding authors at an early stage of their career. And I mean, I published, together with Mike Ripley, who co-edited that particular anthology, I published Lee Child's first ever short story.
Right.
Years ago in an anthology called Fresh Blood. And Lee, who's obviously has been grateful ever since, and has always done new stories for my anthologies.
Handy person to be able to call on, yes.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, I have a quote on my covers from Lee Child, but obviously Lee is generous to everyone.
That he is a generous fellow, that's true when it comes to that. But I mean, were you involved then when you came over? You sort of been with the French science fiction scene. Were you involved with J.G. Ballard and Brian Aldiss and Michael Moorcock and the others?
Yes. In fact, I mean, I was not only friendly with them. I mean, I've known Mike Moorcock since I was 17. I've known Mike through thick and thin ever since. And through Mike, obviously, I met Jimmy Ballard, and we became quite friendly over the years. And we did, because of my contacts with French publishing houses, we did quite a few events together in France and in Italy. And he's not only a good friend, but also somebody, obviously, who has been quite a big influence and somebody I admired enormously. He was a good friend, and when the publisher, having done the Woolwich Anthology, said, well, what are you doing next? Well, it's not crime, but I'd love to do a book inspired by Jim's writing. And they said yes. And oddly enough, when I put the call out, it was a bit like the Woolwich. I put the call out for the anthology, and obviously there are a number of people that I had half the stories I had commissioned.
Right.
And then lots of people came out of the woodwork saying, oh, I'm also, I mean, Adrian.
Right. So it was one that people were desperate to be part of.
Quinty in America, or David Gordon. I would. Mm. Wonderful noir writers said, oh, we're great Ballard fans.
No,
so there are also crime writers in there.
But no, that must be a really great way to honor a friend like that. I'm going to ask you one last question then. And as a critic, of course, which is something that you do, what about a recommendation, something for people to perhaps read? Or I don't mind if it's a film, actually, because you're into films as well, of course.
I saw what I think is my favorite film of the year just yesterday night. So,
all right, okay,
comes to mind straight away. It was a preview. In fact, I met Willem Dafoe on the occasion because he was there to introduce a film. So we managed to have a chat in the green room before, and quite a really nice guy. Is Yorgos Lanthimos' Poor Things,
right?
Coming out in January, and is based on an Alistair Gray novel, and it's a most wonderful, crazy, obscene, hilarious film I have seen this year and probably for many years. I mean, written by Tony McNamara, with whom who also wrote the favorite for him and most of his other films. And it's absolutely wonderful. I see it's just come behind Barbie and Oppenheimer in the Golden Globe nominations. I think it's opening in the 13th of January. It's basically, I would call it a baroque noir Frankenstein thriller.
That's pretty good, because when you said Alistair Gray, I thought, I won't ask you to explain it, because that's quite a task in itself. But what I will do is I'll make sure these are in the program notes, any references we've made today, so people can pick up on things we've talked about. But Maxim, that's been brilliant. Thank you very much.
No, it's okay. Thank you very much for reading the book so attentively and coming up with all those questions.
Well, I hope you agree. That was a brilliant way to start off the new year. If you want to buy Just a Girl with a Gun, you should be able to get it from all good book outlets, or they should be able to order it for you. You can certainly get it on Amazon. If you want to order it from us, you can click the link on the program notes, and that'll take you to Telos Publishing, the publisher, and you can get it there. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and subscribe with your favorite podcast provider. I'll be back with another interview very shortly as we begin our special spy month. But for now, bye, and thank you very much for listening.